Hello, folks. Welcome to the August 2016 edition of First Thursday. This is the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System at our world headquarters here in Portland, Oregon. My name is Will Aitchison. For the next 45 minutes or an hour or so, I'll go over recent developments in public safety, labor relations, public safety including law enforcement, corrections, and firefighters. I'm going to start a new policy this time because it occurs to me I haven't been really following those that basic adage of journalism, which is tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. That's the advice that apparently every new newspaper writer gets. So let me tell you what I'm going to cover over the course of this month's podcast. And we have six different areas that I'd like to talk about. The first two involve the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'm going to talk about a kind of a bombshell new decision concerning how you calculate the overtime rate under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that, if that is not enough to get your blood stirring, then I'll talk about a decision from Virginia on whether firefighter captains are exempt under the FLSA. I'll then move to an interesting decision out of the Florida Supreme Court that holds unconstitutional some limitations on workers' compensation benefits, particularly those that impact public safety employees. I'll talk a little bit about a decision upholding the right of the state of Wisconsin to ban residency rules at the local governmental level, and how the city of Milwaukee unsuccessfully challenged that statewide ban. Then a fascinating case that involves the relationship between pregnancy discrimination laws and light duty status. And then if I have time, I will end with a topic that isn't really that groundbreaking, but does come up from time to time. And that's the issue of whether or not a labor union has a duty of fair representation to bargain for retroactive wage payments for retirees when it is bargaining for a contract that includes some sort of retroactive wage increase. All set? Let's get going. And I want to start with those two FLSA cases that I talked to you about. The first one comes to us from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's out here on the West Coast. Ninth Circuit is by far the largest federal court of appeals, has the most judges, has the most cases. It tends to be fairly ideologically split. There are some very, very conservative wings in the Ninth Circuit and some very liberal wings in the Ninth Circuit, and a great middle that's between them. On Fair Labor Standards Act cases, for about the last 6-7 years, the Ninth Circuit has been one of the more conservative in the country, conservative in the sense of pro-employer. There have been lots of cases decided in the Ninth Circuit that might well have come out differently somewhere else, where the Ninth Circuit sided with an employer, but other courts may not have, and in fact have not, sided with employers in exactly the same cases. Well, this one's a kind of a turnaround for the Ninth Circuit. It's ruling in favor of employees, and the question is, how do you calculate the overtime rate under the Fair Labor Standards Act? Here's the structure that the Ninth Circuit had to deal with. The Fair Labor Standards Act itself has two subsections that deal with how you calculate the overtime rate. If you are counting, they are Section 7A and Section 7E to the FLSA. Section 7A is the broad statement of principle. And that broad statement of principle is the overtime rate is time and a half the regular rate of pay. That's not necessarily time and a half the hourly rate. A regular rate of pay is a term of art that is defined under the FLSA. And how is that term of art defined? It is defined as including all remuneration for employment. Think roughly. If it shows up on an employee's paycheck, it should be factored into the regular rate of pay and thus into the employee's overtime rate under the FLSA. That's what Section 7A does. what Section 7E does is the other half of that classic paradigm. It's what taketh away from Section 7A. Section 7E says, yeah, all remuneration for employment does get included except these things. And then there's a long list, a fairly long list, I think there's about 8 or 9 of them, a list of things that are payments to employees that aren't included in the regular rate of pay. So when you're handling these sorts of cases, the first question you ask is it remuneration for employment? Does it show up on the employee's paycheck? And if the answer to that is yes, then you turn to Section 7E and you say, do one of those exceptions apply? So what's going on in this Ninth Circuit case? Well, it comes out of California, a suburb of Los Angeles known as San Gabriel. And San Gabriel, like many cities, has what's known as a flexible benefits plan for health insurance purposes. And under the plan, what the city does is to give each employee whatever the negotiated dollar amount is for the purchase of medical, vision, and other benefits, dental benefits, whatever. An employee can decline to use some portion of those funds if they prove they have alternate medical coverage. For example, your spouse has medical coverage. And if the employee elects to forego those medical benefits because they have alternate coverage, they can receive the unused portion of their benefits allotment as cash on the next paycheck. And so the question is that cash back, should that be included in remuneration for employment and thus in the overtime rate? And this is a big deal, I think, for a couple of reasons. First of all, lots of employers have these cashback options built into their health care plans. They make a good deal of economic sense because the cashback payments are typically less than providing the employee with coverage that may well be unnecessary. So it's a big deal for that reason. Secondly, it's a big deal in terms of the amounts that are involved here. The cashback amounts that employees in San Gabriel could get were up to $1,304 in 2012 per month. If that amount ends up getting included in the overtime rate, that's going to have a significant impact on the employee's overtime wages. And what does the Ninth Circuit says? It says included in the overtime rate. The big battle is around one of those Section 7E subsections. And this is a subsection 7E2 that allows an employer to exclude from overtime calculations payments that are made to an employee, and I'm quoting here, that are not made as compensation for his hours of employment. So Section 7E2 goes on to say these are things like traveling expenses and other reimbursement for costs and things like that. A mileage reimbursement rate would surely fall into this category. Probably a clothing allowance would fall in this category. And the employer is saying, look, these payments for unused benefits, they're not tied to hours worked. They're not tied to the amount or quality of the services that are provided by the employee. Therefore, they're not made as compensation for hours of employment as the statute is worded. The Ninth Circuit says, close. In fact, the court actually says, that's a close question, but city, you are wrong. The Ninth Circuit points to a Department of Labor regulation that it believes supports its position. And the court ends up saying, and I'm quoting here, it makes no difference whether the supplemental payments are tied to a regular weekly wage or regular hourly wage. In other words, the question of whether a particular payment falls within the other similar payments clause of Section 7E doesn't turn on whether the payment is tied to an hourly wage, but instead turns on whether the payment is a form of compensation for performing work. And the court ends up saying, this is compensation for work. The employee's not going to get it if they don't do the work. Therefore, you have to include this in the overtime rate calculations. The court was also influenced by another one of those Section 7E exceptions. This one, Section 7E4, that excludes an employer's medical insurance payments from the overtime rate calculation. And the court ends up saying, in one of those classic things courts usually say in these circumstances, hey, Congress knew how to use these sorts of words if it wanted to. It specifically did use words like them when it said medical premiums are not included in the regular rate. It could easily have said cash back in lieu of medical premiums will not be included in the regular rate, but it didn't. And so we're not going to presume that that's what Congress's intent was. And in a big double whammy in this case, the court found that because of that Department of Labor position that was out there that I described, the court found that the employer's violation of the FLSA here was willful. And that meant that employees got the benefit of a 3-year statute of limitations and not a 2-year statute of limitations, and also meant that employees got double damages, liquidated damages under the FLSA. So, if you have some sort of cashback payments in your medical insurance plan, you better be checking to see whether or not those benefits or those cashback payments are included in the calculation of the overtime rate. Yeah, this is just the Ninth Circuit. It's just one part of the country, and other federal circuit courts of appeals are not obligated to follow what the Ninth Circuit does. And sometimes some other courts of appeals relish in not following what the Ninth Circuit does. But this is a result I'd actually expect pretty much anywhere. And the reason is you've got that Department of Labor opinion out there. And I think that's going to be a big deal. And in the while you're up department, while you're taking a look at the calculation of your overtime rate, let's review some other types of remuneration for employment that courts have said need to be included in the regular rate of pay. Because not all of you are doing that. I know it. Not all of you are doing it. What else needs to be included in the regular rate and thus in the FLSA overtime rate? Longevity payments, education incentive pay, certification incentive pay. On the fire side, if you have like EMT certification pay. On the law enforcement side, if you have post-certification pay. All that gets included in the regular rate of pay. Specialty pay, premium pay for hazardous duty, working out of classification pay, where you receive a higher amount of money if you're temporarily working as a sergeant or a battalion chief or whatever it might be. Shift differential pay, standby pay, all of those things and more have to be included in the regular rate of pay. And we're going to make an offer to you because this is a problem that I think a lot of employers and employees have. This is going to be a no strings attached, absolutely free offer. If you have any questions about whether or not your overtime calculations are right under the FLSA, get in touch with us. Send me an email, will@lris.com. Outline what you think the issue might be. Provide the calculations, or if you don't have the calculations, provide the pay stubs. And I will give you my off-the-cuff opinion as to whether or not the overtime rate is being calculated correctly. Please remember, I'm not your lawyer. I'm not licensed to practice in all 50 states, so everything I say in response to you sending in pay stubs or whatever it might be, you should not rely on. You should be checking with your local counsel. But I'll at least give you my 2 cents worth. This is just such a rampant problem that it's one that I think we need to get control of. All right, what about that other FLSA case? This comes from the other part of the country. This is another Federal Court of Appeals opinion, and this is from the Federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. I like talking to you from time to time about the politics of these various courts. The Fourth Circuit is one example of a huge change in jurisprudence that came with a change in presidential administrations. When President Obama took office, the Fourth Circuit was, I'm not sure I want to say the most conservative federal court in the country, federal appeals court, but if it wasn't, it was really in the running to be the most conservative. You could go years without an employee or a labor organization winning a case in the Fourth Circuit. But those judges in the Fourth Circuit, when President Obama took over, were getting ready to retire. And before the Republicans in the Senate started the, we're not going to confirm any of the president's nominations for the federal bench, before they started that thing, the president actually was successful in getting a whole bunch of nominations through, and it changed the complexion of the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit went from being an incredibly pro-employer federal court of appeals to one now that, if anything, may have swung the other direction. I've seen some decisions from the Fourth Circuit in the last year, you know, that kind of make my head spin, sort of like, you know, Reagan in The Exorcist. It's like, really? This is from this court? This is one of these cases. And this is a case whether or not fire captains who work for Fairfax County in Virginia, whether they're exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act. The county had treated its fire captains as exempt, what are called under the FLSA, executive or administrative employees. It didn't pay them overtime, and the fire captain sued. The trial court judge ruled in favor of the county, said they're all exempt because they have supervisory or quasi-supervisory duties. And the captains appealed, goes to the Fourth Circuit, and a unanimous court, that even shocks me even more, holds that the captains aren't exempt. What's going on in the case? What's going on is that in 2004, the Department of Labor promulgated what it referred to as its fair pay regulations. Now, most of those regulations were aimed at cutting back how many employees were eligible for overtime in this country, and did so by changing what had been known as the duties test, where if employees performed certain duties, they were exempt and not eligible for overtime under the FLSA. And the estimates were that millions and millions of employees lost their right to earn overtime with these kind of ironically named fair pay regulations. I think the number I've seen most people alight on is that 8 million Americans lost their ability to claim overtime. And you would have these decisions, I'm thinking of one from the very self-same Fourth Circuit here, in the wake of the fair pay regulations that would hold that employees were exempt, and you'd say, really? I can think of one involving a manager of a Dollar General store. You know, those stores where everything is less than a dollar or a dollar it costs to buy. This is someone who, if I remember the court's opinion right, and whenever I use that phrase, that means I'm kind of sort of making it up, but if I remember the court's opinion right, this 98% of this employee's duties were the same as her subordinates. She was doing things like sweeping the floors and restocking the shelves and checking people out and everything like that. 2% were kind of low-level supervisory administrative duties. And the Fourth Circuit held she was an exempt executive under the fair pay regulations. A highly compensated exempt executive. What was her compensation? $12 an hour. So, at any rate, you got these 2004 regulations cut back on the right of employees to get overtime under the FLSA, with one exception. And the one exception dealt with public safety employees. and the Department of Labor issued what has become known as the First Responder Regulation. And again, for those of you keeping track of these things, it's Section 541.3 of Title 29 of the Code of Federal Regulations. We'll put a link for that on our webpage. Basically, what this regulation says is those exemptions, the executive, administrative, and professional exemptions, they don't apply to first responders, and I'm quoting here, regardless of rank or pay level, if they're actually engaged in line activity. So if law enforcement officers are actually out there making arrests, executing search warrants, whatever it might be, they're not exempt no matter what their job title is or what their pay level is. And on the fire side, if they are actually out there engaged in fire suppression duties, they're not exempt no matter what their title might be. And that's exactly what the court holds here. The court upholds the validity of that Fair Pay Act exemption or language, the first responder language, looks at the county's fire captains and decides because they engage in fighting fires, they're not exempt. I'm shorthanding a pretty long opinion, but that's the essence of what the court is saying. The county is saying, wait a minute, these captains only spend a small portion of their time actually fighting fires. Most of the time, they're at the station. And the court says, you know, doesn't really matter. And here's, I'm going to quote a couple sentences from the court opinions here. Like all first responders, the captains are required to participate in training, emergency response training, which takes an average of 2 hours per shift. Putting all this together, the court says, we find no reasonable jury could conclude by clear and convincing evidence that the captain's primary job duty is anything other than emergency response. What about the notion that the captains spend very little of their work time responding to emergency calls? The court says, we think your argument, county, misunderstands kind of the nature of firefighting. It's true that a captain's firefighting duties don't consume the majority of his or her time, but that's the nature of first response work. Back to the court's opinion. Any given day for a firefighter may consist of extended periods of boredom, punctuated by periods of urgency and moments of terror. The regulation directs attention not to the amount of time performing non-exempt work, like fighting fires, but specifically to the amount of time spent performing exempt work. There's no inverse correlation between the two. You can't assume that simply because a captain is not at the scene of the fire, that they are out there performing exempt work. Back to the court's opinion. On the contrary, some of the things firefighters do at the station while awaiting emergency calls, like sleeping and eating, are decidedly non-managerial. So, fire captains not exempt under the FLSA if they are actually out there performing suppression duties. Okay, let's go down to Florida now for that big decision out of the Florida Supreme Court. This is a long-running battle that's been going on in the state court system in Florida for years and years. This is the ultimate case in that battle. It's been there have been some skirmishes, but this one that winds up in the Florida Supreme Court is the end of the story on this whole issue. And you can tell how big the case is because it attracts all sorts of friend of the court or amicus briefs. In the end, there are more than 15 lawyers who are involved in this single case. And of course, if you put 15 lawyers on a case, well, you're bound to get quite a handful. This is a case that's simple enough. It deals with a provision in Florida's workers' compensation law. Let me set the stage for you just a little bit. Workers' compensation laws typically have two types of benefits. One are called or fall under the heading of permanent benefits, and the second are temporary benefits. You get permanent benefits when you've got an injury. It leaves you with a permanent disability of some sort or another, and your file is closed out, and you get some sort of award, maybe a cash award, maybe a monthly payment award, depends on the state, but the judgment has been made somewhere along the line that you are what the law refers to as stationary. You're not going to get better. You're not going to get worse. This is your permanent condition. Then you get permanent benefits. You get temporary benefits up until the point when that decision as to whether you're stationary is made. So you get temporary benefits when you suffer some sort of on-the-job injury or you have a job-related illness, and in the period of time when you are recovering, when you're getting to the point where you will be stationary, where you won't get better or worse, then you get temporary benefits. This provision in Florida law cuts off temporary benefits after an employee has received 104 weeks, 2 years, of temporary benefits. And it cuts off temporary benefits without regard to whether the employee is stationary. So in other words, the employee may well be getting better, may well be in a position where they will be eligible for permanent benefits. And if you hit that 104 weeks, you're done. Can't come back to work, of course, because you're disabled. Your workers' comp benefits have ended. It's time for you to do something else. And I don't know what the something else is. That probably have to ask the Florida legislature for that. So that's what's going on. That's the statute. This is a case involving a firefighter, a fellow named Bradley Westfall, a 53-year-old firefighter in St. Petersburg, Florida. He suffers a severe lower back injury by lifting heavy furniture in the course of fighting a fire. He ends up with extreme pain, loss of feeling in his left leg. Multiple surgical procedures are required, including an eventual spinal fusion. At the end of 104 weeks, when his doctors are still saying, you're not medically stationary, you're getting better, at the end of 104 weeks, the city cuts off his workers' compensation benefits. And Westfall ends up appealing that denial all the way through the court system to the Florida Supreme Court. And the Florida Supreme Court holds the statute unconstitutional. The court relies on a provision of the Florida Constitution that exists in a lot of state constitutions. You'd have to check your own state's constitution to see if it's with you, but it's in a lot of them. And I think of these provisions as kind of access to the court's constitutional protections. And the way the Florida one reads is just one sentence. The court shall be open to every person for redress of any injury, and justice shall be administered without sale, denial, or delay. And the Florida Supreme Court says, the question here is whether the workers' comp law, with its 104-week limitation, remains a system of compensation that is an adequate substitute for the court remedies that employees would otherwise have. Okay, back to the grand compromise that workers' compensation laws are. When workers' comp laws were enacted, many of them in this country in the early 20th century, the grand compromise was employees get these benefits without regard to whether they were at fault in causing the injury. They get these benefits. In exchange for the workers' comp benefits, they give up the right to sue their employers for on-the-job injuries. That's the grand compromise. And what the Florida Supreme Court is asking is, by enacting this 104-week limitation, has the Florida legislature gone so far that it has, in essence, denied employees of either the right to access to the court system to sue their employers for on-the-job injuries or a meaningful workers' compensation benefit? And the court says there's a tipping point out there. That's its phrase. There's a tipping point where the diminution of benefits becomes so significant as to constitute a denial of benefits, thus creating a constitutional violation. And here's what the court says. As applied to Westfall, the current workers' comp statutory scheme does not just reduce the amount of benefits he would receive, but in fact completely cuts off his ability to receive any disability benefits at all. It does so even though there is no dispute that Westfall remains a severely injured and disabled firefighter under active treatment by doctors the city selected for him. Now, here's the answer to the $64,000 question. Back to the court. It is uncontroverted that decreasing substantially the period of payments from 350 weeks, what they had been, to 104 weeks, standing alone, results in a dramatic reduction from almost 7 years of disability benefits down to 2 years. Whereas almost 7 years or even 5 years post-accident should be a reasonable period for an injured worker to achieve maximum medical improvement, clearly 2 years is not enough for the most severely injured of workers like Westfall who might be in need of multiple surgical interventions. And then the court ends up showing a surprising degree of sympathy. You don't see this too much in court opinions. The court says the natural consequence of such a system of legal redress is potential economic ruination of the injured worker, with all of the terrible consequences that this portends for the worker and his or her family. And the court declares that cap unconstitutional. If you've got a clause in your state constitution that is like this, and if you have a monthly cap, or excuse me, a cap on the number of months or weeks that employees can receive workers' comp benefits, you definitely want to be taking a look at the case of Westfall versus City of St. Petersburg. Now let's talk about residency rules, particularly this one in Wisconsin that became the subject of a huge political battle followed by a huge legal battle. And it comes out of Milwaukee. And Milwaukee has for many, many years required all of its employees, including police and fire, to live within city limits as a condition of employment. Also, Milwaukee actually has provisions in its, I think it's in its charter, that mandate that any employee caught living outside the city limits be fired. That may not be in the charter, that may be in an ordinance, but nonetheless, it's a mandatory termination offense. Well, in 2013, enter the Wisconsin legislature. The legislature enacts something that is called Act 20. And Act 20 says a couple of things. The first thing it says is, public employee residency requirements are a matter of statewide concern. Why would they be a matter of statewide concern? Because they impact, or so says the legislature when you look into the legislative history here, they impact the ability of public employers in Wisconsin to recruit the best and the brightest. They impact the pool of eligible employees. All of us travel from city to city, from county to county, that is an impact that is felt on a statewide level. So that's the first thing the legislature says. is residency requirements a matter of statewide concern. The second thing it says is, it's just one sentence. I'll read it to you. No local governmental unit may require as a condition of employment that any employee or prospective employee reside within any jurisdictional unit. In other words, all residency requirements are eliminated, at least to the extent that they require residence within the city limits or the county limits. I have a question that's not answered by this case. Perhaps one of you who's from Wisconsin can elucidate this for me. Under this Act 20, could, for example, Milwaukee have a rule that required employees to live within 20 miles of Milwaukee's city center, or 40 miles, or live within an area where they could manage a response time of 30 minutes or an hour? I just wonder that because this is phrased, the ban on the residency rule is phrased in terms of you can't make any employee reside, and I'm quoting, within any jurisdictional unit. And there are other types of residency restrictions. At any rate, one of you from Wisconsin has an answer to that question. I'd be very curious about it. So Act 20 passes in 2013. The city doesn't take kindly to it. The city council immediately passes a resolution that it's going to continue to enforce its residency rules come hell or high water. That brings a lawsuit from the Milwaukee Police Association, later joined by the Milwaukee Firefighters Association, and after some hearings before a trial court, the issue comes up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And the court upholds the constitutionality of Act 20, and in other words, holds that the state has the ability to ban residency requirements, these sorts of residency requirements for local jurisdictions. The battle in the court was over a constitutional provision in the Wisconsin Constitution. This is one, again, that appears in many different state constitutions. You can think of it as a home rule section of the Wisconsin Constitution, and that gives cities and villages the ability to determine their own affairs, subject only to the Constitution, and subject to, and I'm quoting, such enactments of the legislature of statewide concern as with uniformity shall affect every city or village. In other words, the court is forced to look at this home rule provision and say, is there a legitimate statewide policy concern? And if there is, how do we balance this against local interests with respect to this? And the court says, look, Act 20 is a mixed bag. It concerns both statewide and local interests. But the court ends up saying that it's going to, at least for the first stage of its analysis, it's going to give the city the benefit. It's going to decide, the benefit of the doubt, excuse me, it's going to decide that Act 20 is a matter of local affairs, and so under the odd rule wording of this home rule provision in the Wisconsin Constitution, it's then going to say, did what the legislature do, was that uniform? Because if it was uniform under that home rule provision, the state can enact it. And the court ends up saying, yes, Act 20 is uniform. It uniformly affects every city or village. It explicitly says no local governmental unit may have a residency requirement. Goes on to define a local governmental unit as city, village, town, county, or school district. Consequently, says the court, Act 20 uniformly bans residency requirements, and in so doing, it satisfies the Home Rule Amendment's uniformity requirement. This is not, I don't think, an unexpected result. I'm going to go back a few years here, but this was sort of the same battle that was played out when statewide collective bargaining laws were first enacted around the country. The big spurt in collective bargaining laws came in the early 1970s. There were some before that, some after it. And in many states, you had local employers challenging the statewide collective bargaining laws on the basis of home rule provisions in state constitutions. And with pretty much one exception, and I'll get to that in a moment, courts rejected all those challenges and said collective bargaining, a matter of overriding statewide governmental interest, and the result is that the state has the power to impose collective bargaining even in spite of home rule provisions in a constitution. The one exception is in California, where a California court many years later ruled that a binding arbitration violated another provision in a very unusual California home rule constitutional clause. So for a long time, we've seen these rulings around the country that these matters of statewide interest that involve personnel questions like collective bargaining or residency, also civil service, I can think of a whole bunch of them, that these matters of statewide interest are not going to be derailed by home rule provisions in a constitution. That's exactly what this Wisconsin case holds. This next case, the pregnancy case, is one I've been waiting for a long time. I always hesitate to say this is the first case in the country that addresses the issue, but I can say this is the first case I've seen addressing this issue, involving the relationship between a light-duty policy and pregnancy discrimination. This involves a corrections officer, a woman named Anne Marie Legg. She's a corrections officer for Ulster County, New York. And the county, for a long time, had a light-duty policy. And the only people who were eligible for the light-duty assignments under the policy were employees who had suffered on-the-job injuries. And, of course, because pregnancy doesn't result from an on-the-job injury, at least one would certainly hope not, pregnant employees did not get the benefit of the light-duty policy. They could use sick time or vacation time or personal time or take FMLA leave or disability leave if they met the requirements of any of those, but they were not eligible for light-duty. Well, Legg becomes pregnant in 2008. She's had some previous difficult pregnancies that didn't make it to term. And so her doctors decide that her pregnancy is high risk. Her doctor gives her a note that says that she's able to work but shouldn't have direct contact with inmates. The sheriff then directs the undersheriff to deny Legg's request for light duty work. And the undersheriff ends up taking a very aggressive position that employees are given light-duty assignments only at the sheriff's discretion and only for work-related injuries or illnesses, and therefore Legg is not entitled to light-duty work. Well, eventually, Legg gets clearance from her doctor saying that she is able to work with no restrictions, and for a time, she goes... she is assigned to light-duty work, kind of ironically, and that is done by virtue of her interaction with one of her lieutenants. This is one of these fascinating things that doesn't show up in a court's opinion. The lieutenant comes to Legg and says, hey, you know, if you can get your doctor to modify that light-duty restrictions thing, if you can get him to release you for duty without restrictions, I'll put you in light-duty job. What's not stated is whether the lieutenant did that at the request of the sheriff. We just don't know, or whether the lieutenant was just cutting a deal. But at any rate, that's what the lieutenant said. Legg gets the note, and then she goes back to work. And for a time, that all works out. The lieutenant does assign her to light-duty tasks, but gradually she's required to work with inmates again. And then when she's 7 months pregnant, she comes on two inmates fighting in the bathroom and gets bumped as one runs past her. And she decides that's enough. She leaves work, doesn't return until after she gives birth, and then she and three other female corrections officers sue the county, saying that the light-duty policy amounted to pregnancy discrimination in violation of what's known as the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, the PDA, that's now been incorporated into Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Legg loses at the trial court. She doesn't even get a trial on the merits. The court says the light-duty policy doesn't discriminate against pregnancy, doesn't even mention pregnancy, therefore it's enforceable. Legg loses, and Legg appeals to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Second Circuit reinstates her lawsuit. And what the court says is you can't be automatically throwing out this lawsuit, because Legg established what's known as a prima facie case of discrimination. And she established that because some people were given light duty work. Those people were people who had on the job injuries. And some people were not. Those were pregnant people. That's a prima facie case of discrimination. And I'm going to quote a couple sentences from the court's opinion here. A reasonable jury could conclude that the county imposed a significant burden on pregnant employees because it categorically denied light-duty accommodations to pregnant women. Indeed, the county admits that of 176 corrections officers during the sheriff's tenure, just one, Legg, was pregnant, and she was denied an accommodation. The court says that's enough for a jury to decide this case. And so we have what certainly is one of the first rulings in the country on whether or not a light-duty policy can potentially violate the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. And the answer that we are seeing is yes. It's at least enough to raise a jury question as to whether or not the PDA has been violated. Last case I want to talk about is one you see come up with a great deal of regularity. This one's also out of New York, and it's the question of whether a union has a duty of fair representation to bargain for retroactive wage increases for people who retire before the new contract is put into place. This is a case involving a fellow named Gregory Packey, who works for the village of Pelham Manor in New York as a police officer. He retires in March of 2014. He retires as an officer. He was a member of the Pelham Manor Police Association. And the union's contract actually expired about 10 months before Packey retired. It expired in 2013. Packey retires in 2014, and in 2015, the union reaches a settlement with the city or the village. And the settlement limits the payment of retroactive salary increases to those members who were employed at the time the settlement was reached. Because Packey had been retired for a year at the time the settlement happened, he didn't get a retroactive wage increase. Packey brings an unfair labor practice charge against the union, alleging that it breached its duty of fair representation owed to him, and the whole issue was teed up for an administrative law judge for New York's Public Employment Relations Commission. And the ALJ dismisses the charge. The ALJ says, first of all, to be liable for breach of duty of fair representation, the union has to engage in conduct that is arbitrary, discriminatory, or in bad faith. Simply because you disagree with the union's tactics, or you're dissatisfied with the quality or extent of union representation, that doesn't amount to a basis for a successful duty of fair representation claim. You have got to show that the union's conduct was far beyond the pale, was this phrase, arbitrary, discriminatory, or in bad faith. And by the way, just as an aside, that's the standard for duty of fair representation pretty much everywhere. That comes from actually a series of United States Supreme Court decisions that go back into the 1940s on the origins of the duty of fair representation. So what is Packey saying? Packey is saying, hey, you breached your DFR, duty of fair representation, by agreeing to a settlement that didn't include retroactive wages for retirees. And that settlement in and of itself reflects bad faith or arbitrariness. And the ALJ says, no, that's not the case. Bad faith requires a showing of conduct that is deliberately invidious. Even a showing of action that's irresponsible or negligence is insufficient. And, Packey, you haven't shown that level of improper motivation here. Also, to be arbitrary, an action must be so far outside a wide range of reasonableness that it's wholly irrational. And, Packey, you haven't shown that here either. What the union did here was it balanced a whole lot of competing and ultimately inconsistent bargaining objectives. It wanted to get raises for people. It wanted to get retroactivity for people. It wanted to preserve certain sections of the contract, the language in certain sections of the contract. No matter what decision it made on this contract, somebody was not going to be happy. Some portion of its bargaining unit was not going to be happy. And the ALJ says, and I'm quoting, it's well established that an employee organization may negotiate a benefit that favors some members over others as long as there's no evidence of bad faith or intentional relinquishment of a vested right. The bare allegation that a union has agreed to a limitation on employee eligibility for a certain benefit is not enough to establish a breach of duty of fair representation. It's extraordinarily hard for union members to sue their unions for any breach of duty of fair representation, even where the union refuses to take to arbitration a case where an employee is terminated. It's rare you see a successful duty of fair representation case, but it's even rarer to see one where the claim against the union is that it drew an inappropriate balance between competing bargaining objectives. The law just gives unions the right to make those decisions, with the understanding that unions often are going to be in a position where a decision they make will favor some members over others. Think about it for a moment. Isn't that the essence of a seniority clause? However you apply seniority in a collective bargaining agreement, isn't that helping some members and hurting some others? And labor boards and this ALJ in New York say unions have to be able to make those decisions. Well, that's it for this first Thursday. We've got an advanced disciplinary seminar coming up in Las Vegas in September. Hope to see you there. If not, we'll hope that you join us for next September's first Thursday. This is Will Aitchison signing off.